I can't deal with this nonsense. Like, these stories are unbelievable. Like, stories of fake suicide, death, guys getting cremated and found in the jungle. And, you know, I could get into that. I'd just rather not end up dead myself.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Zeros TV and the short story. Today, I'm joined by Warren Irwin, the founder and CIO of Rosso Asset Management. Warren, I've interviewed you before, and I have heard some of the crazy stories that you've had in your investing career. You've been all over the world, and you've seen it all. Why don't we just start out? What is some of the crazy stuff that you have seen in the scammiest of the scammy companies?
Well, you know, I focus on the resource industry, because that inherently involves a lot of sketchy companies. But, you know, obviously, I had a front row seat for the whole BRIEX scam. I've had properties taken over by the government. I've had the KGB murdering people I know. I've had, stories of guys showing up dead, guys showing up waking up dead one morning with their balls in their mouths. You know, you name it. I've given money to auto parts companies where the companies have basically immediately stripped the money right out of the company and put it into a shell company to lease cars for the Toronto Italian mafia. Like, so we've dealt with all sorts of things, whether it be the cartels in Mexico, the KGB, the IRA, you know, the Italian mafia. I haven't dealt with the triads, but they all seem to get into the resource business somehow.
Well, I think before we get into some of the particular stories that you mentioned, I think we should start there. And why does that happen? Why does this industry tend to attract people? Some of it is jurisdictional, just because the natural resources are found all over the world, and you can find yourself in places where rule of law and crime is a little bit different. But as well, the industry itself just has some markers that just bring in people.
Yeah, well, it's just from the day of Mark Twain. Definition of a gold company is, you know, a hole in the ground with a liar on top. There's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of people have, you know, when you talk about gold, a lot of weird things happen. And oil's kind of similar too, but there's nothing like a gold rush to get people excited. All you have to do is look back not that far, the early 1900s, late 1800s for the, you know, what happened in the Klondike gold rush and everything else. And what happens to people when there's a smell of gold in the air, people lose their minds and they go crazy. And we see that in the gold business all the time.
Well, one of the things I think is most interesting, I want to get into BRIEX a little bit now, is that I know that you made money on both sides of the trade. So a lot of people, they find out about these scams after the fact in the gold mining world and they're left holding the bag. You were actually a little bit quicker than most, and you made money on the scam on the way up, figured out was a scam, and then shorted it and wrote it on the way down. So why don't we start at the beginning and when you thought that BRIEX was a long?
Yeah, well, I was director of special investments for Deutsche Bank Canada, and my partner and I had made the bank a ton of money investing in various distressed debt situations and distressed real estate, because in the mid 90s when I was there was a lot of opportunity there. So over the time in my own personal activities, I'd built up a bit of an expertise in the resource market. So about that time, there was a really good resource market building, and there was a massive win in the markets with Robert Friedland and his Diamond Fields Resources. He made it was a 4.3, I forget whether it was US or Canadian dollars, but around between $4 and $5 million was made by the market, which in the mid 90s was a lot of cash. So the time was ripe. We were getting the beginning of a gold market, and in the resource sector, Robert Friedland just found a massive nickel deposit in Labrador. So there was about $4 to $5 billion worth of speculative money sloshing around. So it was a great time. It was just primed for a scam like BRIEX.
Well, and for people who don't know, BRIEX is one of those crazy stories where people did turn up dead. And actually, yeah. I believe it's the impetus for the movie with Matthew McConaughey, Gold. It's loosely based on the BRIEX story, is what the writers claim.
Yeah, no, loosely based, yep. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely loosely based. I remember I've read a few of the scripts for competing movies, and in my opinion, Gold is a little less closer to what actually happened than the other scripts I've read and assisted people with. So, so what happened was, interestingly, when the movie Gold did come out about 20 years after the original scam, it got a lot of us in the mining business talking, and I wrote an article a few years ago about my experience with the BRIEX scam. It's a short one. It's about four pages. For anybody who has an interest in the resource sector, I encourage Googling my name and Brex, B-R-E-X. You'll come up with this article. It's 4 pages long. It talks about my trips through the jungles of Kalimantan and jumping on a plane going to Indonesia without any permission to go on sites, and some of the trials and tribulations of Brex, and some of the things that happened. And as a young guy right out of MBA school, fresh out of MBA school, I think it was around 95, 96 that I got into it, and I graduated in 91 from MBA school. So it was quite a learning experience, kind of compacted into a very short period of time. It involved all sorts of shenanigans.
What made you think it was a good investment? Because obviously any good scam pulls people in first. It can't obviously be a scam. So why don't we start out with, you know, what attracted you to it? And then we can get into when did you start to find the breadcrumbs? And then when did you totally know? And then actually the trading of it, the how you changed your position and got that conviction to go short. And then just, you know, all the salacious details. I mean, I believe there's people falling out of helicopters, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, leave none of that stuff out.
All right. Well, Brex is a classic because I first got wind of it when a trader buddy of mine said, Warren, there's this really amazing gold situation in Indonesia. You should really take a look at it. It's pretty exciting. A buddy of mine is one of the largest shareholders. So I rolled up my sleeves, and what was ideal for me is it was around the mid-90s. So I'd spent, right after MBA school, I went to Jakarta, Indonesia, to visit one of my profs as part of a Southeast Asia tour. He was living the high life there, teaching at a business school. So he lent me his car and driver for the day. So I drove around with him to see the different areas, from the slums to the palaces that were being built in Jakarta. So I learned that one thing, that there was a ton of money in Jakarta, and a lot of people were making a lot of dough. And Indonesia is also home for one of the world's largest and richest copper deposits, the Grasberg deposit owned by Freeport. So there was some serious money being made. So that set in my mind. So when I heard, and I'd also had some loser friends of mine get involved in this gold story in northern British Columbia, Canada, in the early 90s. And I went up to the site with them to check it out. So I'd worked with this, and I'd had some experience valuing, you know, junior gold situations. So it was kind of interesting that I combined the two things that I knew reasonably well together. So I'd been to Indonesia. Not many Canadians or North Americans have. I knew how things worked there a little bit. I knew a little bit of the language. And I also knew how to value gold companies. So it was right up my alley. And my buddy, his friend, was the largest shareholder. So the stock was trading at the time at around $13 a share. Apparently his buddy got in at around a nickel or a dime. And so I got into it. I pitched it to the bank. I had done some work on it. I'd plotted all the drill holes, did a resource model. It was clear to me that they were onto something pretty big, and it could get quite big. I approached it to our investment committee, which just wanted to double check with them to make sure they were happy with me doing this. And they weren't. So what they did is I said, okay, if you guys aren't happy with me trading some of the bank's capital with this, I guess you wouldn't have a problem with me trading. So they said, they gave me the go-ahead, and I was allowed to personal trade it. So I took my entire life savings at the time, which is about $250,000. And so I put $250,000 to work. I tried to get in at 13. I was being kind of stupid. I was trying to get it on the bid side. And for all of you young traders out there, don't dick for a tick. So I was on the bid side all the way up to 18 bucks. And I finally got filled around 18. So that cost me millions of dollars, a lesson I learned. So I was loaded up with $250,000 worth of stock at 18 bucks. And to give your listeners, you know, some excitement here, the stock eventually went to $280. So that was the fun part of it. As my net worth went from 250, I think, to a high, I had about $5.6 million worth of stock in my personal account as a young punk kid in the early 30s. Like, I think it was like 30, 31. There was quite a bit of money, and I had $1 million margin loan against, which I thought at the time was pretty prudent because, $5.6 million, $1 million, you know, it's less than 20%. So I'm not sticking my neck out too far. So I had a lot riding on it. I'd built up quite a number of connections by being on the phone all night. I was a bit of a night owl. I'd go to bed when I get home from work, and I'd stay up all night on the phone to Indonesia, running out $1,500 monthly phone bills. And it was clear to me that I needed to get down to Jakarta in Indonesia and see the site. I managed to phone up, you know, the office manager in Jakarta. I talked to the company, and there was, you know, everybody and their uncle wanted to get on site. So I had to do something a little bit different to get on site. So I said, well, you know, it's going to be way tougher for them to say no to me if I'm sitting in their offices in Jakarta. So I took a bit of a flyer and I jumped on a plane and flew to Jakarta and met with the office manager and said, hey, what are the odds of me getting on a site tour? And he goes, Warren, listen, we'd love to have you, but all the helicopters going into site are full with mining analysts, big investors and that sort of thing. I said, that's fine. I'm here. I'll go standby. If anybody doesn't make it, I say, well, Warren, you know, everybody will make it. Don't you worry. There'll be no seats in the helicopter. But, you know, if you go to a town called Balikpapan, which is a big oil town on the southern tip of Borneo, the big jungle island where I believe the Sultan of Brunei is in the very top, and then there's Kalimantan, which is the Indonesian part of it. So at this stage, I've flown halfway around the world to Jakarta, and only that, I've just even gone further, put even more chips on the table by going to Balikpapan. So that night I arrived, I met with Mike de Guzman, the head, one of the senior geologists, and John Felderhoff, head of exploration for the company, and they agreed to show me a company presentation. And then I said, guys, is there any chance of me getting the helicopter ride in? They go, Warren, we're full up, no rides. And I'd had a plan B, which was I'd studied maps of the area, and I was going to pay a ton of money to somebody to take me up the Mahakam River for like an 8-hour river boat ride, and then I was going to buy a motorcycle and ride another 30K into the site from the Loa Duri, which was one of the little towns on the river. So I was ready to do that and make it to site regardless. I went to the presentation and got an update as to what they were up to. Then we went out to drinking to a bar. I went out playing pool with some of the local guys there, including the head of the assay lab, and we're sitting there drinking beers and drinking beers in the tropical heat with a couple Aussies, and there's an Australian head of the assay lab there, and he looked a little nervous to me. So I said, John, there's gold there, isn't there? And the poor guy nearly jumped right out of his skin. So that was sort of my first concern. I was going, this guy should not be, first of all, as nervous as he was, or let alone almost jump out of his skin when I asked him if the gold was really there. So that's not, doesn't make me feel super good. Well, you know, the next morning I'm up bright and early with my bags packed saying, okay, guys, any room in the helicopters? And they go, Warren, you're in luck. We had a guy lost his passport in Hong Kong, and there's one seat left. So I got the last seat in a Huey into the site. There was notably three helicopters going in. There was an Alouette 3, which is more of the bubble type with the car doors in the front and the sliding glue doors. And then there was two Hueys that everybody was familiar with. So I was in one of the Hueys. So we chopper in, we stop off at, I believe, Samarinda. And then we took the final flight into site, landed on the site, and we spent 2 days there. And I was always looking around, just going like, you know, what's going on? And I guess even at the time I was questioning enough things, going, are the locals fooled? Are the locals building their, and I looked around and I said, well, all the locals are building their houses right at the front gate. So they're obviously thinking there's some economic activity here that they'll want to be part of. And then I went on site and I saw a number of the drillers, and they're Australians, but you know, the gold wasn't visible in the core. So, you know, they might have been kind of fooled. So on site, I was there for 2 nights is my recollection. And again, it's over 20 years ago. And so I remember asking John Felderhoff, I had enough of a question that I said, John, when are you going to twin these holes? As in, get an independent third party in to drill parallel holes right next to it just to verify your results. He said, well, that'll happen in the fall. So when I got back, that was sort of my view. I said, I was just, you know, it was really good. The locals were fooled. The geos were fooled. I even found the name of a geo who had quit the company. He was a Canadian guy. And I said, listen, anything going on that's anything untoward, everything all good? He said, yeah, Warren, everything's great. And he was busy starting another Indonesian mining company because there was a massive area play. So when I get back, as luck would have it, you know, a few days or probably a few weeks after I got back, I was in my condo going to work and I was reading the newspaper. And the front page of it was a big discovery, Briex Minerals, multi-billion-dollar discovery. And there's this old guy next to me in the elevator. And I was looking at him, he says, I said, yeah, can you believe this gold discovery? And I said, he goes, yeah, it's quite a situation. I said, yeah, I just came back from there. And he said, you did? He said, well, we should probably have lunch. And I said, why is that? He says, well, you know, I've been in the old gold business a very long time, and we should probably sit down and grab some lunch. So the guy's name was Dale Hendrick, and he passed away very recently. So Dale and I had lunch, and he said, You know, I tried to get on site, on the site tour, but John Felderhoff, the head of exploration, wouldn't let me. And he says, I think it's a scam. Felderhoff's got a scam going here. And then he rattled off, you know, the 20 reasons why he believed it was a scam. And everything from, the original Australians who had the property before had already done a lot of drilling and they found nothing. And BRIEX went in there and the Filipino geologist, it reinterpreted the core and somehow came up with, you know, couple million ounces, which you just can't do if there's nothing in the core. He had talked to the Australians and said, guys, listen, he said, Dale, listen, we've been there. Like there's no gold there. And these Canadians are coming in with these Filipino geologists and saying there are, there's gold and they're making resources without even doing any drilling. And he just went on and on and on with all these reasons he believed there was a scam. And I had counterpoints to almost every point. And what concerned me is that Dale was a pretty sharp old guy. And I was concerned he was working as a consultant for one of the major mining companies trying to take a run at BRIEX. At that point, remember, there was Barrick was trying to buy it, Placer Dome was trying to buy it, Teck was trying to buy it, and of course, the hometown favorite, Freeport, was trying to get involved in the deal. Here I am, a young punk kid, early 30s. I have this old mining guy telling me this is a fraud, yet I've got every major gold company in the world's desperately trying to get involved. So I'm going, you know, it's a real mind game for me. But as time went on, I just started, you know, when the fall came and went and and Felderhoff didn't twin the holes, and I'm getting flashbacks to what was going on with respect to the head of the assay lab in Indonesia. And all these things started to come back and haunt me. So I started opening up to some of my contacts in Indonesia, and I said, guys, listen, there's a chance here this could be a fraud. Can you guys just keep an eye out for me? And one of my contacts there was John Macbeth from the Far Eastern Economic Review. Very, very sharp reporter. He'd reported in, you know, over the Vietnam War. He was involved with, you know, he was dealing with the Khmer Rouge. Like he knew everybody in Southeast Asia. He was a pretty sharp guy. He was also very tight with Jim Bob Moffat of Freeport. He was into the mining community there. We were trading ideas rather freely overnight. I would feed him as much news as I could that was newsworthy to him, and he'd feed me any of the gossip. So we had a good relationship going, and my builder, I was building a BRIEX house at the time, my builder goes to me, Warren, I'm going to need a few million bucks here to finish off your house. And at that point I said, you know, with all these concerns that Dale has, and you know, I've watched a few of my friends blow up with a bit of debt, so I said, I'm going to take myself off debt, repay the $1 million margin, I'm going to pay my taxes, and I'm going to have enough money to finish off my BRIEX house, which is quite a nice house. So I forget, I think I cut my position in half. I was following it very, very closely. And then, you know, a few months later, I get a call in the middle of the night. Warren, they've killed De Guzman. De Guzman's dead. I think they've killed him. And I go, oh, man. I go, what's going on now?
Who is so they? I had to ask, who is they in this scenario?
He believed his scuttlebutt in Indonesia was the Indonesians, possibly in concert with the Indonesian military. And he believed they threw him out of a helicopter. Sure enough, the next morning, I'm ready to just to hit the market with all my stock, and it's all halted. And the news comes out, BRIEX is concerned, you know, with great deep regret, we've lost, you know, Mike De Guzman, blah, blah, blah. So I immediately get on the phone to Jakarta, and the office manager there, and I said, okay, well, what happened here? Like, was it a helicopter accident? What was going on? Well, you know, it was, and all the speculation in Toronto was that Mike De Guzman accidentally fell out of the helicopter while he was choppering around site because, you know, safety's a little bit more lax. People don't always belt in. So then I just phoned up the office. I got some admin person. I said, you can just tell me, where did Mike fall out of this helicopter? And they go, well, he fell out of the helicopter en route from San Marinda to the site. And I'd already been on that exact route, and I knew the pre-flight inspection was very thorough, and they strapped you in, and they checked the doors, and the flight engineer... Well, the safety was very, very strong, so I knew that you just don't fall out of a helicopter, right? And I found out the helicopter that he fell out of, which was the Alouette 3, which is, you know, Mike De Guzman would have been sitting in the front. It's like car doors. So when you're moving forward from San Marinda to the site, you can't open the doors because the wind force on it would be quite strong. So it had to be intentional. So I said to myself, you know, oh, we're going to get some fun stories the next little while. And sure enough, so what I did is as soon as the market opened, I sold all my stock. I said, I've had enough of this. My nerves were frayed at the time and I actually went short.
Relative to the size of your initial position, how big did you size the short?
Not super huge. Actually, by that point, the bank had enough faith in me. They let me trade it. So I actually bought $500,000 worth of put options on behalf of the bank. And then with myself, so I'm not doing the same thing the bank is, I just went short. So there's no commingling. Like I would short the stock and I bought options for the bank. So there's no concern about anything there. I got approval from management to do that. So sure enough, and then a few days later, I'm going, you know, I must be just going a little crazy here. We've got all the major gold companies in the world. And now I've got this theory that Mike de Guzman was killed or murdered or whatever. And sure enough, I said, I bet you I know what's going to happen. There's going to be some suicide note come up. And sure enough, a couple days later, there's a suicide note. Mike de Guzman jumped out of the helicopter because he couldn't handle the pain of his hepatitis B. And I knew he had hep B, but he said the pain was too much. But then I remember back, I saw Mike probably 3 weeks earlier in Toronto at the Prospectors and Developers Association conference. And he was running around with probably about, you know, half a dozen hookers. And he and his Filipino geologists, they were having the best time of their lives. And I go, you know, thinking back, this really doesn't look like a guy who's suffering from the ailments of hep B and is ready to commit suicide. So that didn't sit well with me. And then we started reading about it. And then what do you know, they found the body out of the middle of the friggin' jungle. And but the body, of course, had been eaten by wild hogs, and that it was pretty messed up. And this was in the days, kind of the mid 90s, when you know you didn't have a GPS in every helicopter, so to find the body was miraculous. And of course, you know, the family swears up and, oh, this is Mike. Yeah, we sure he was eaten by the hogs, but we recognize the hump on his shoulder as Michael. So next thing you know, before you know it, somebody in Indonesia signs off, this is Mike de Guzman, and he gets cremated, and he's at he's now in some mausoleum outside of Manila, I think. And it's in my article. I wrote the exact location of it down. So Mike's dead, and I'm going, boy, this is not good. And then, you know, a couple days later, the core shack, which stored some of the skeleton core, miraculously went up in flames, I guess, a day or two before Freeport was sending somebody there to do some due diligence. And just things started to get really, really wacky. But then my head's playing with me, and I'm going, you know, I've smoked too much weed here. I just can't. I can't deal with this nonsense. Like, these stories are unbelievable. The stories of fake suicide, death, guys getting cremated and found in the jungle, and pigs' bodies, and then this is just getting too much for me. I've had a good run. I got to stop this. And so I went in. I remember with the bank's position, I went in with the bank and I tried to cover the option position. I said, okay, the stock's only gone from, at this point, it was at a 10-for-1 split. So it's gone from, let's say, $220 pre-split or $22 down to $19. So I'm going to unwind the bank's position. I've just had enough of this. So we've made some money for the bank. And then the options traders were trying to rip my face off, to the point where I said, all right, you option trader guys, I'm just going to hang on to these options till expiry then. Just thank you very much. And then with my personal position, I said, I'll just leave it on. What the heck, right? So I forget how big it was. It might have only been a few hundred thousand dollars.
When do we get to the part where the market started to realize, like, this thing is a scam? Like, you had the kernels, you realized it, you had convinced the bank, but you know, the market at large, what made it for them? Was it de Guzman, or was it the cores going up?
Yeah, one thing happened before the market knew. What happened was they started to put out some dud results, as in some results which had no gold in these drill holes, which was kind of weird to me. And here I am trying to hold my head together mentally with all these mind games that were going on. So I remember back to my undergraduate math degree, and my stats prof from second year gave me these techniques. Like, assume there's 200 drill holes released in batches of 10, so 20 groups of observations of 10. And there were 6 dud holes released, but the only 6 dud holes were released in the blast basket of 10. So I plugged it all into the equation, and the odds of this happening were 1 in 40 million. So I'm going, this, you know, when I got math backing my suspicions, this is quite interesting. Then I was calling my contacts in Sydney, and they were saying, Warren, you know, we're getting rumors here that there's some calcitic rims in the gold that were in the assay lab, meaning it was alluvial gold, not in situ disseminated gold. And so basically the source was from the streams that washed down from the mountains, not from an in situ hard rock source.
So that's like gold from a river versus
gold from a river, because usually a river it's a secondary source. It's been eroded from the original gold source, and then it forms these calcitic rims, which I'm not a geo, so I don't know, but it's an indication of alluvial gold. So this is starting to hit me. So I'm going, man, I'm pretty sure. Like I trust my math. I said 1 in 40 million. This is a scam. So then what happened is, as there's the rumblings of it being a scam started becoming more and more prevalent, the CEO David Walsh, who I do not believe was in on the scam, I believe he was hoodwinked by his head of exploration and Mike DeGuzman. He hired Strathcona Mineral Services to do a third party assessment, and they basically came out with a report saying it was a well orchestrated scam. And one of the finest they've seen, and the best examples of salting, which basically means putting gold in the sample bags before they went to the lab. And how they did it is a Loa Duri, where they were about to where they shipped the samples out from. What they did was very sophisticated. They took a, because the risk of salting, meaning putting gold in samples, is the samples are so small that if you put too much gold in, you're going to get crazy numbers. So you need to gently salt them. So what they'd done is they created this 50 gallon drum of the salting material that they would just take a scoop of and throw it in the bags, and it was such that it wasn't going to overwhelm the samples. So it was very meticulously done. There were rumors that Jim Bob Moffat from Freeport resigned because they'd orchestrated to the market that it was a scam when it really wasn't a scam, and they were working in cahoots with the Indonesian government to take, by this point, 100 million ounce deposit away from poor little Briex. And then the stock rocketed in my face from, I think, a couple bucks to $7. Then I phoned up the CFO of Freeport. He actually took my call, and he said, no, Jim Bob Moffat did not resign. So we put a kibosh to that rumor, and that collapsed from $7 to $2. And what's interesting, if you go to Silicon Investor, all these chat rooms from 20 years ago are still online. So you could read exactly what was happening. I think the final nail in the coffin was a Strathcona report. And I eventually covered my short at a few pennies before they delisted the stock. And like I said, I bought enough to build this mansion, and probably about $1 million walking around money. And then I bought enough to buy the top of line Mercedes S600 at the time. For anybody with any further interest, I wrote an article in part to basically explain how Michael De Guzman's alive and living in the Philippines now, and how shortly after he was reported dead, one of his four wives that he was keeping was sent $200,000 from a Citibank in Brazil, and then another $25,000, and how, so he was wiring money to his wives after his death, and how my buddies and new people who've had lunch with Mike De Guzman since then. And one of my buddies was in the Philippines. He was sitting there having lunch a few weeks after Mike De Guzman had apparently fell from the helicopter. He was having lunch with a bunch of geologists who just stood up and gave this guy who was leaving the restaurant a standing ovation. And my buddy goes, "Why are you guys clapping?" He goes, "Well, that's Mike De Guzman." And alive and well, walking around the Philippines after he was dead. I don't know where they got the body from to cremate, but you know, you could pick up a body pretty cheap in Indonesia.
And to a lot of people, it might sound like something. Obviously, this was an extreme example of some of the ridiculous things that can happen in the natural resources space. But I think it's important actually now just to highlight that this wasn't as crazy as you would believe. It's really just one of the only ones that has been widely reported. And you, in your experience, you've seen so much more. And so I'd like to turn now to just some of the examples of the type of stuff that maybe it's not like a total scam where they're ripping off the market, but just the way that dirty dealings are intertwined into this industry that you've had to see.
I've dealt with the cartels in Mexico. You know, their MO is generally to, hijack gold shipments. There's some questions as to whether that was orchestrated with the company as a way to give protection money to the cartels to make sure, okay, we'll let you hijack a gold shipment every 3 years and then just leave us alone, let us do our business, right? That's another one. Stories of like my buddies driving to mine site visits and you'll see, you know, 9 decapitated heads on the side of the road of the police officers, you know, that they were killed and decapitated. And there's issues with the IRA. Okay, those are issues, of course. Issues with the Colombian drug cartels, the Italian mafia. They're generally outside the mining business because there's not a lot of mining in their operations. But, you know, like I said, I've had the Italian mafia steal some of my money and lease cars for the higher-ups in Toronto. The one guy who died, who was found, who woke up one morning with his balls in his mouth, that was obviously an Italian hit.
What business? And was it a publicly traded company?
Yeah, it was. It's not widely known that's what happened. The only reason I did a bit of investigative work and I found somebody who'd open up to me as to how he died. And he was bludgeoned to death with a candlestick holder sort of thing, just like almost like the game Clue. And he woke up with his balls in his mouth. And I could get into that. I'd just rather not end up dead myself. But just suffice to say, there's some bad shit going on there. And people managed to extract quite a substantial amount of money from the company. Yeah, then there's an instance I was involved in where a friend of mine did something I would not have done, which was, and he was murdered by the KGB. I won't get into that just due to the, you know, he was a friend of mine and I know his family, so.
Well, I guess one of the things that we should talk about is it seems like with Briex, you find this criminal underbelly to it and it's a total zero. But not all of these businesses that you're talking about are total zero. So how often is it that, yes, this is there, it's part of it, but that's just part of doing business in that region or in that industry, and it doesn't really have any bearing on whether the stock is a buy or a sell versus this is an indicator that it's a short?
Yeah, you have to tiptoe. You know, for instance, having, I won't name names because, again, I know people involved in the situations, like, where you have one organized crime group, sometimes if you're going to operate in that country, you need to make sure that you're on side with them. So it's just reality, right? And some CEOs of some gold companies have been dumb enough to say, oh yeah, we've got a great relationship with the cartels or with this organized crime. Like, you don't say that, okay? You just shut up about it and you just make sure that you're out there making sure that you do good things. You have your conversations with people with the cartels. Well, you know, there's not a lot of money in the gold business versus the cocaine business. So what would you like to see us do to be good neighbors here? And he said, well, you know, we'd really like you to hire these guys for security. And we'd really like you to build a hospital and a school and a few other things. And we go, consider it done, you know. And so, there's a lot of things done around the world to make sure that, and sometimes, you know, having a criminal organization in some areas, given they're making so much money with the drug trade, they just want their local region to be nice and quiet, crime-free, and they'd like to have the local people gainfully employed so they're actually supportive of mining to provide jobs for the people and keep everybody happy, and they go about their business discreetly from the mining business and everybody's happy. That's one scenario. And there's other scenarios where, the drug trafficking or whatever illegal activity they're involved in is not maybe as lucrative. And, you know, to hijack the odd gold shipment here and there might make sense. You know, like, and the other one is obviously always at risk here is nationalization. We've had, I've been involved in a number of situations where things are nationalized. And it happened with Khan Resources in Mongolia. We got, I think, $150 million settlement from the international courts on that one, and I believe that they paid up. It's a few years back. There's also a classic example is where the local government/crime organization will orchestrate some sort of protest. I don't want to name the countries because I'm operating in some of them. One example would be the one government/crime organization orchestrated a cyanide spill. And this cyanide spill, they got all the locals down the river saying, oh, we're feeling the ill effects of cyanide, despite the fact that the amount of cyanide that fell off the truck and into the river was infinitesimal, given the amount of water flow. And they said, well, you're going to have to, you're not a good operator in this country. We're going to have to take over your gold mine because of this. So they'll orchestrate situations where they'll try and extrapolate, trying to take over your property. We had another instance where I was involved in a situation. Again, I can't really name the country, but, you know, so we're moving forward with a gold project, and we made sure we were dealing with the local communities, and all the mayors in the local area were all happy. We're building schools and hospitals and making sure that we trained as many of the young people to work on site as they can, helping with sample bags, and we were probably providing, you know, a few scholarships for young, smart people to go to university to become geologists. We're good corporate citizens. We're building bridges where they want to build bridges, and we're working with them in a very positive way. But there were a group of people just outside of that region who wanted a slice of the pie, and they were orchestrating protests. They were getting a criminal element there. I had a guy on the ground working for me. He was a reporter who was almost killed by this criminal element that was orchestrating the protests. And they were trying to get, they were hiring a bunch of locals for these protests with the criminal element right in the middle. And they were trying to get the army to shoot one or two protesters, because that would have been the home run for them, right? Because then, it didn't happen. The army kept their cool. Despite the criminal element trying to cause conflict, but they did threaten the guy I had working for me with death. And so that's just another situation, par for the course, and where we operate.
Well, it seems like some of the things, there's not really anything you can do to trade it. But I know we've talked about, you know, you are one of the natural resources guys that I think I most respect for your ability to make money on both the long and short side.
Yeah.
So when it comes to shorting natural resources companies, especially ones that are pre-revenue, a lot of the things that, you know, people come on and they talk about shorting, like there's some forensic accounting that can be done to determine that this isn't a real company. But when you're dealing with things that are, you know, it's really about the quality of the asset that they own, it's pre-revenue. How do you go about determining whether something is a scam? How do you go about shorting that? Obviously, you know, you talked about the options guys trying to rip your face off with Briex. Well, I'm sure that's partially because there's not a huge liquid options market for some of these names. And so when it comes to actually shorting these probably hard to borrow, hard to short through options, how do you go about managing those positions?
Yeah, that's very true. Especially the smaller cap ones, is impossible to get borrowed. So the ideal ones to short are the ones that have been very successful and have actually multi-billion-dollar market caps, because they're liquid. You could probably get, you know, you get borrow, right? And once the protection you get too is, once you get to that market cap of a few billion dollars, you get some downside protection as a short, because they can't necessarily, they generally don't go from a 2 billion market cap to a 6 billion market cap. That's a very rare takeout in the mining business, especially for an early stage project. Shorting in the resource sector right now is not the right time to do it. Where we are right now in the resource cycle, let's take a look at the mining cycle. We're at the beginning of a mining cycle right now, and there are not, what happens with the mining cycle is it's very, very cyclical. So let's say we've had a 5 or 7 year downturn in the mining cycle. So generally what happens is all the scams are cleaned out, right? So the ones that are remaining in today's market, in general, they're not outright super duper scams. They're actually good companies, or they have some level of legitimacy to them. The real fun comes when we're 5 years into this bull market, and this bull market is just starting. So we're 5 years into this bull market, we should have this conversation again. And when we have these scam companies with $800 million, billion dollar, billion two, billion five market caps, and we know they'll never be put in production, we know there's serious metallurgical issues, we know there's serious issues with the indigenous people in the region, and it'll never get built, that sort of thing. That's the ideal time to do that. Like, for instance, right now, I know of a company that has a pretty significant market cap that I believe is a complete promote. It's not a scam, but they're just lying their faces off at every point. They're overhyping it, and a bunch of naive investors are getting involved, and it's definitely not worth the market cap. But I'm not shorted. The reason I'm not shorted is we're at the beginning of this mining cycle, and if they continue to promote it like crazy, we could see 800, a billion to market cap on this. And so the ideal time to short these names is we have to let the mining cycle go a bit. Let more and more scam companies come into the sector. They're generally, let more naive investors come in, because right now, if I was to short a legitimate short, you're going to get, in a good bull market, we're going to get tons of naive investors throwing money at these companies, and they'll rip these companies in my face. So let a few more scams be created over the next number of years, 3 to 5 years, and let the market get a little bit more frothy. And then as we notice the market starting to turn, you want to have both company fundamentals and the cycle on your side. To short in an up cycle in the metals market is quite a tricky time and quite a tricky thing to do. So my view is, don't be short at these points. Keep an eye out for the point in the future where everything will be aligned and your ride will be a lot less rough.
And for those of us who can't jump on a plane to Indonesia and go take a site visit, when we get to that point in the cycle, what are the things that you would be looking for?
The first thing would be an unsustainable market cap would be the one. A project that just does not have the grade to become economic might have some metallurgical problems. You know, the company right now that I'm thinking of has grade that's uneconomic. And so if you're looking at, as the mining cycle rolls over, if it is uneconomic at whatever price that commodity gets to, if it's borderline economic or uneconomic at that point, as commodity cycle rolls over, well, you're not going to get higher prices to skate that situation on side. The risk you run here too is if you say, listen, I'm not investing in a copper project with a 0.4% copper grade because it's uneconomic. You know, well, guess what? $15 a pound copper might bring a lot of people who'll jump on that bandwagon and rip that stock in your face. So we kind of need to see a little bit of a rolling of all the major commodities, you know, copper, nickel, gold, and a lot of them starting to roll. And that'll be a ways off yet. We've got a bit of a bull market ahead of us here. We've got a lot of room to run here with all these capital programs, whether it be the electrification of the world, whether it be all these trillions of dollars being spent on capital programs, whether it's building out electrical infrastructure, building out wind farms, and building bridges. You need iron ore, you need met coal, you need copper, you need nickel, and various other things you'll need for the EV market. You know, you'll need some battery metals. You don't know exactly which ones quite yet because they haven't, you know, dialed in to the battery metal yet. And there's an innovation every day in the battery metal side. So we're kind of winging it, thinking what will be in these new generation batteries. You're hearing news articles from time to time. Oh, this whole new battery will charge up in 10 minutes now. And it doesn't involve cobalt, doesn't use nickel. It uses, you know, lithium and some other really, really cheap metal, right? So that's where I may have mentioned before that I'm playing the commodity copper. I'm playing uranium for the EV cycle. And I've obviously involved in the steel business a bit, mostly through metallurgical coal. The coal used to make steel, not to burn, to make power. It's the one that made steel. So,
well, I think we'll definitely have you back to talk about some of those topics a little more. It has been great getting these war stories and getting to hear just how crazy things can get in the natural resources space. Normally I say, you know, thank you so much. I guess I have to say, you know, be safe out there at the end of this one. And you know, to all the mafiosos watching, you know, we don't know any names.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Max. I hope you enjoyed my stories. And yeah, and for any of the mafioso out there, don't kill me.
Yeah, we'll keep it generic. We'll keep it generic.
Yes, generic as can be. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Max. And I enjoyed speaking with you.